forever.
Welcome to Foidcast. We're here with a very special guest, Curtis Yavin.
Hello, hello, hello.
Welcome.
Very, very honored to be on your show, which is, a monument on Twitter, and I don't actually listen to podcasts, but people tell me it's good and it's got good marketing. So I'm here in London, and I thought I'd do it.
Oh, I thought you might give us a categorization in like elf hobbit terms.
A categorization in elf hobbit terms.
Having spoken to us a bit, would you?
Yeah. No,
I mean, you guys are dark elves.
Yeah, we're small, like mini elves. Like you're not. I don't know. You know, elves are large. You know, the elf men are like 6'6". You know, even the woman, you know, often 5'11". So you guys are a little smaller than that.
I'm pretty small. Yeah.
A mini elf.
Yeah.
And
I'm Welsh. I don't know if that rules me
Welsh.
Out.
Welsh. Yeah, no. There's a kind of Cambrian edge there. You know. Are you a speaker of Welsh? Do you speak?
I am. Yeah.
A native speaker.
I do.
You grew up speaking Welsh.
I went to Welsh school, so everything was taught in the medium of Welsh.
That is amazing. I had no idea there was still Welsh school. That's
yeah.
like really
you
like,
get detention if you speak English. Mm-hmm. They're really tough about
you
it.
You get detention if you speak
yeah.
English.
Yeah, even like a word, even one word.
Did your parents have an ideological reason for sending you to Welsh school, or was it?
No, they're better schools. They're less rough.
What, really?
Yeah, it's a bit more like upper class to speak Welsh because it's more
right.
more farming, more like rural gentry.
Right.
Wales never really developed a class system in the modern
and are there
sense.
A lot of are there a lot of Mirpouris in your Welsh school or not?
No, I only met one non-white person before I moved to England.
Yeah.
I think
moved
even
to England.
It's changed,
wow, this
changed
is a
now.
Very strong nationalistic perspective.
That's how we think about it here. I mean, I wanted to talk to you about the patchwork stuff. I don't know if you still subscribe to that because it's something you wrote in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess devolution is one such working example.
Mm-hmm.
But in at least in the British context, the devolved parliaments are very progressive.
You mean a communist?
So I guess it's quite different to the kind of US like Silicon Valley context that you were writing about initially, where
I'm
you're
sure.
thinking about these like CEO type like
well, you know, it's an interesting
states.
It's an interesting question because basically, you know, what makes a nation? And, you know, you can sort of see the making of the nation from the bottom up. Here are a bunch of Welsh people. They have a feeling of like, you know, to really be a sort of Welsh nationalist in a way is to say, for example, you just naturally prefer Welsh people over non-Welsh people. You know,
yeah.
you have a feeling of community. Let's say, you know, there's a way to sort of express, this will be a controversial thing for me to say, but, you know, there's a certain number of situations, at least in America. In America, we're very big on tipping.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's a thing here, but like less so. But like when I was a kid, you tip 15%. That was standard. Now it's like 20%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll give you these screens like 20%, 25%, 30%,
yeah,
you know, for...
It's very embarrassing because, like, they give you the receipt and then it's like, you have to take it in front of them and it's like the first one, the 15%.
And then, like,
right.
like if you can't afford to tip, you just shouldn't go and eat.
And I know. And the whole thing is supposed to be for, like, personal service. And so you get a thing where, you know, when I was coming up, as they say, basically it's like, all right, if you're being served at a restaurant by a human being who is serving you, it's not optional. But if you're at like Starbucks,
mm-hmm.
it's optional.
Yeah.
Right. You know, morally speaking. And so given that it's optional, it's sort of okay, I think, to express your kind of Schmidian friend-enemy energy in the form of, do I tip this person or not? You know, is this person one of us?
Mm-hmm.
Right, you
yeah.
know, and if it's not one of us, then you don't
just
tip.
Tipping all the white people and stuff.
Well, it's so rare that you get one, and I'm like, wow, good for you.
You're like, you need the money because
yeah,
somehow
yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
got
well,
here.
Well, you
know,
I mean,
there's
a test, you know, to be very serious and sociological here. There's a test that someone came up with, which was like, for a country, which is the McDonald's test. You know, and the test is, if you go to McDonald's and you get the chicken nuggets, is the person, what is your social distance from the person who gives you the McNuggets? Like in terms of degrees of separation, is this person part of your community, or is he or she, you know, a slave who was imported from the Philippines 3 months ago? And the question of basically, it's like, actually, it's like currently the person who does our house cleaning is a friend of my wife's. But the previous people who did it were Brazilians. And I was basically like, what is my social distance aside from this professional, you know, what is the social graph link that links me to these Brazilian people who clean my house, who see the disgusting things that I do to my toilet, you know, and corrects them, you know, like what is the social graph that connects me to these Brazilians? And I'm like, you know, it probably runs through some Brazilian aristocrats I met in Sao Paulo, you know, but it's probably like 15 steps long.
Yeah.
And when you have a kind of, there are a lot of definitions of slavery, but I think one of the
what Welsh means, you know.
Of course. Oh, it means foreigner. I thought it meant foreigner.
It means foreign, Romanized foreigner, but then it came to mean in Old English slave, or particularly slave girl.
Slav also.
Yeah.
Literally slave.
Yeah. It's like, you know. Yeah, of course. I mean,
we're just like,
slavery is a human universal, right? You know, I'm not saying slavery is bad. I'm just saying that you want to define like what it is, right? You know, and in this situation, you're basically like, yeah, actually, there's a. Are you familiar with the term mudsill theory?
No.
This is mid 19th century Americana. And mudsill theory was this idea, like, really, you know, posed by some Southern intellectual, and it really pissed off the North, because basically the Southerners, like, look, I know you don't understand our social system, but in any society, there's sort of a mudsill, which is like a piece of the house that rests directly on the dirt or something. Somebody is always cleaning your toilet. Right. And
well,
so
it's got to do with nationalism.
And so, you know, the Southern, you know, I'll get there. I'm doing a Putin, okay?
We've got a lot of questions.
You know, the Southerners are like, yeah, you know, we have these, they didn't use the word slave. They would say like servant or whatever. But, you know, they would say to the North, hey, you know, do you do clean your own toilets? I mean, they even have toilets. That's something, you know. But do you clean your own toilets? No, you're importing Irishmen to do it, right? Mm. And you have this anonymous relationship.
But do you want to be connected to someone who's cleaning your toilet?
That is an interesting question. And actually, I have a story. Okay. So this was like a little over 25 years ago.
It's like a weird kink thing.
So a little over 25 years ago, I was living in the classic San Francisco way, that is with roommates in the Mission. And I was living with this guy named Zach Brown. I don't know where Zach is. Zach, if you're hearing this, you should email me. It's really fucked up because I can't Google you because you have the same name as a famous country singer. Zach and we basically solved this problem by hiring a woman who was, in fact, a friend of a friend whose name, you know, and sort of a fellow cool person, obviously everybody needs money, whatever, you know, whose name was July, and which is a cool name, I think. And, you know, July, frankly, she was kind of hot. And so Zach ended up dating July. And so he was like dating the maid, right? You know, and I was just like, man, you know, this is like a... some like D.H. Lawrence shit here, right? You know?
Yeah, some conflicts.
It's like reverse D.H. Lawrence. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know, something.
I guess everyone wants to be ruled, right? That's...
Sometimes, because I think we should get a cleaner, but because I'm Eastern European, I really don't want a cleaner, because I used to be a cleaner. And I feel like if I got an Eastern European cleaner, there would be some really weird, like, racial dynamics there where it would be like, I'd be like, I came up and you haven't come up.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of kinds of Eastern European, right? They might not be the same kind as you. And you could, you can get a Slav. Yeah, you could get a Slav, right? You could basically say, okay, we need this kind of, you know,
it's get like there should be.
I mean, you know, it should be like, this is a, come on, let's think seriously, girls. This is like a startup idea. Like, you know, you're basically ordering, like, slaves.com, right?
I think that's sex trafficking.
Slaves.com, you know, and I mean, it's not sex trafficking.
I keep ending up in these situations that feel very close to sex trafficking.
Many such cases. And you don't do anything to, like, cause these issues.
I don't think so. Maybe I just give off a vibe. Maybe,
I feel like you post erotically online. It's kind of enough, because you just have to be pretty and post something about sex.
I don't even post.
Or not even.
About sex. Joke. No, anyway, back to the patchwork thing.
Well, already off the rails.
Yeah, I mean, you wanted to ask about ethnicity in terms of patchwork, right?
Yeah, well, so to sort of go back to the question of Wales, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, nations are often created by, like, strong leaders and strong sort of forces where, you know, it's like France is like a bunch of different mutually unintelligible languages, and they come together and become like one thing. And so there's a kind of top-down energy. There's also a bottom-up energy where, like, Italian is a bunch of different languages, and people are like, you know, Italy must come together. And like 1848, Italy must come together and become a nation.
Yeah, although, sure.
I was going to say Italian is my least favorite European.
They're my favorite.
No, but Southern Italians are Northern Italian because it's...
I like the South.
I like them. They're just obsessed with their food. And they're like, once I was like drunkenly making tortellini.
Really, it's like the best food.
Yeah, but it's like you're making drunken tortellini and an Italian man in your flat is like...
Why have you got an Italian man in your flat?
Mind your business. He's cleaning my toilet.
I think that's on you.
The things you can order on the internet these days, but you know,
tortellini in front of an Italian, like,
yeah, no, Italians.com. I mean, they'll come to your house, they'll cook for you, you know, and you know, who knows what's gonna happen.
They give you a massage. She was giving me massages. It was very weird. Wow. It was a roommate.
He was coming out now,
and they were roommates.
Yeah, it definitely, like, don't bang your roommates. It's sort of become part of the ethos of
especially if they're Italian, they're gonna like lord it over you.
Italians and Italian. I mean, and even in southern Italy, you know, it's not that they're all, do you know the term lazzaroni? Mm-hmm. You know, so lazzaroni is it's a 19th century term referring to the, like, the Italian underclass, like the Gomorra people or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the old kingdom of the Two Sicilies is a very stratified, hierarchical sort of culture, not unlike the old American South. And so if you've seen, you know, the leopard,
Il
Gatto Pardo, you know, and you'll see that basically the old kingdom of the Two Sicilies, that of course Garibaldi sadly did away with, had these, like, you know, tall, blonde, Norman, you know, descended, you know, ruling aristocrats ruling under these sort of dwarfish brown people who tilled the soil.
I think they're handsome.
Well, but which ones are handsome? The short brown ones?
Like the Al Pacino ones. Like, they're short, but they've got... I think we've talked about Sicilians on, like, every episode.
Sicilian segment.
They've got great bone structure.
Well, you know, when I met my lovely wife, Christine, I of course, asked her what her
genre.
Could
you not just tell? Could you not just ethno?
No, actually, ethnocaster would not really produce an accurate result there, because she's white. She's actually very pale, but not tall. And I asked her, you know, she was married previously, and as a result, has an Iranian last name, which is a little odd, but it's just next. But that's not how she was born. And so I ask her original last name, and I'm like, wow, that ends in a vowel. Like, that's kind of a new one for me, like ending in a vowel. But like, just tell me it's not a small town in Sicily. And she's like,
is she Sicilian?
It's a small town in Sicily.
I would not have guessed that.
And I'm like, okay, it's a small town in Sicily. But like, okay, just tell me, you know, then, okay. She's like, yeah, you know, we have these cousins, but we don't talk to them. You know? She's like, they're in the banana family. I'm like, okay.
Wow, that's so
I guess I better never do you wrong. You
yeah. know? Maybe she's rich. Was she rich? That's a good... The mafia doesn't make you as rich as, like,
no, just making you work really, in a corporate it's job. It's downscale. It's really... It's a dying thing. I mean, even the Sopranos, which is... Which has some accuracy to it, I believe, is kind of like retro. It's just like the golden age of the mafia is
why do you think? Do you think it's like surveillance got to the...
Yeah, it's just also like, you know, the tools of the police got better. I mean, you know, in the 60s, people actually denied that there was such a thing as
a mafia. The mafia is like, a product of feudalism, right? It came out of those, like, war bands that the feudal lords
hired. It's a natural, it's just a natural human kind of structure where you have, like, war bands. Yeah, sure. And, you know, interestingly enough, you know, the sort of the mafia history is that Mussolini was actually quite successful in suppressing the mafia.
Yeah. And then the CIA.
And then the Americans came in and they're like, oh, we have to work with local leaders or something. And the mafia was reborn.
They just do that now in South America.
Yeah, it's crazy like how pro-Mussolini they are in Sicily, actually. Like, like they've got pictures of him still up. And people
pictures
say
of who? Like who?
Mussolini.
Same parts of Spain with Franco.
You go to Pradapio and you can. There's a whole town is devoted to Mussolini.
Yeah, because he got
rid
of
you go
mafia.
To Linz, Austria. Yeah. And I guarantee you the whole town is not voted Hitler Kitchen.
Yeah. People and then in Venice, like, if you say that, you're like,
no, like the Spanish with Franco, like there are some Spanish like outposts and like the Canary Islands and stuff that love Franco still.
The Spanish Azumas are very pro-Franco.
He seemed fine. Like,
no, my mother was...
In the grand scheme of things.
My mother was actually an au pair in Franco's Spain. Yeah. So she like remembers like Franquismo, like... She's like an au pair for like the children of this like Frankist admiral, and of course the children of them.
Wow.
All the young people, it's like 1965. They all want to wear blue jeans. They don't want to be Catholics, you know. You know, they want to like you know get contraception and have lots of sex, you know, and like that, you know.
Hey, who doesn't?
It wasn't gonna last.
Who doesn't? I think that's the problem.
I could answer that.
I wanted to ask you about the British Constitution, if. We wanted something more serious.
Oh, right. We get serious. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I read an interesting article in the Telegraph about how Britain became ruled by judges.
Well, you know, it's very embarrassing. I mean, the thing is, like, 10 years ago or something, you decided you needed, like, a Supreme Court.
2005, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Wait,
20 years ago.
Was that recent?
Yeah,
and I'm like, you know, as an American, you see this, and, you know... It's like, do you have a sister by any chance?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, is it older or younger?
Older.
Older, okay. But it's like your little brother wants to wear your clothes or something. You're like, oh.
Yeah. And it's like, we already had a thing
from their thing, you know.
But I mean, now we have the situation where whenever the government tries to do anything, it essentially can't act. Like, it recently tried to deport
many such cases.
Two migrants in this deal with France.
Did it get any like, of the, anyone over to Rwanda?
No.
Not even a single
there was,
one?
There was one who volunteered to go, yeah.
Because he just had read about Rwanda.
He just wants to go on holiday.
Yeah.
Hey, Rwanda's a cool place. I mean, you know, it's like a really...
And it doesn't just happen with immigration, but it recently happened with, like, attempts to... do welfare reform and the
migrant hotel
that was blocked by the courts on human rights grounds.
Frankly, your king, this Charles III, you know, fellow, has all of these reserve powers. Mm. He can suspend parliament. He can, you know, I mean,
but would never use them.
We were arguing about this earlier because I said that if he tried to take sovereign power now, like fully, he would get like democracy would be done away the next day.
No, I think he could if he wanted to.
The revolution.
But he would never want to.
He would never want to. And you know, one of the I forget who spoke this line. It's an amazing quote. The line is, "The revolution was first in the mind of the king." And so, if you look at, for example, the French Revolution, the cause of this, you know, amazing fucking disaster that is still like you know bedeviling the earth today, was that Louis XVI basically. Got kind of
idiot.
Yeah, well, he was just a fashion slave, and you know, English ideas were very fashionable, and he had like a fiscal problem, and they're like, oh, well, we could be a constitutional monarchy, like England, you know, and he's like lying there as the guillotine comes down on us. He's like, we could be a constitutional monarchy like England, right? You know, and because they were all Anglophiles at that time, there was like very heavy Anglophilia going on. And so if, you know, Louis the 16th or Nicholas the 2nd had not sort of been sympathetic to this idea that maybe I could give some of my power away, you know, the world would be, I mean, you know, the sort of the picture of like the standard internet meme of like the science fiction utopia that we would have unless, you know.
Yeah. Even James the 2nd is sort of deciding to, you know, accept it and go off and.
Well, yeah.
But do you not think, like, if Charles, like, tomorrow was like, I'm going to be the absolute sovereign, do you not think, like, in your own concept of, like, the cathedral and, like, the bureaucrats and the people right below, do you not think they would, like, literally rise up and be like, this is unacceptable?
They don't have the energy to rise up and be like, that's not acceptable. Yeah. And they sort of think of themselves as having that energy, but they actually don't. And this is one of the things, in a way, that the Trump administration kind of proved somewhat accidentally. So it's like, you know, the killing of USAID was really symptomatic in a way, because the reason these Doge nerd kids killed USAID is they're just like, you know, they have this spending fetish, right? Totally retarded. They have this retarded libertarian spending fetish, and they're like, oh, these people don't seem to care what we think. They're just sending money and money and money at the door. Mm-hmm. You know, what is this money going to? It seems to be fucked. And without understanding it, USAID, they sort of killed this thing. I mean, the empire subsists. They killed like a very essential organ of like, you know, I mean, if I were to describe the history of USAID, I would probably start about 100 years ago, or maybe 150 years ago.
Do you think it's actually useful for soft power?
Well, do you think soft power is useful for anything? Yes, it was certainly useful for soft power. Now, you know, what is soft power doing for America?
Because you do talk about soft power.
But the thing is, you know, they sort of, you know, the point in a way is that they basically took this really prestigious and distinguished and relevant organ of the U.S. government, and they just took it out and shot it. And nobody, not even me, would have, well, you know, if I thought about it, no, I would have said that they could do this, but I would have been, you know, I'm surprised that they did that. And like the iconic video of where they're like actually chiseling the name off the building, you know, and, you know, I think there's a sort of reflex there that would have expected like, wow, here's a super important thing that everyone believes in. You know, there's going to be riots in Georgetown. Like the Foreign Service Office, the diplomats are going to riot. They're going to build barricades in Georgetown. And I'm like, no, actually they're not. And it's sort of like, in a way, when in the fall of East Germany, when they shut down the Stasi. And imagine like you're a major in the Stasi, right? You know, in like 1988. Right. You're a major in the Stasi. This is a like very, you worked hard to get that job. Many people wanted that job. They didn't get it. You did. And when you walk into the room and the DDR is a major in the Stasi, it's like walking to a party. It's like walking to a party. It's like a New York Times reporter where everyone is like, ooh, yeah, wow. Oh, I've wanted to meet you for such a long time. Right. You know, you're very like, everyone is kind of explicitly or implicitly sucking your dick. Right. And then and you have this narrative of this position and this tradition that you're part of. And it goes back to like Rosa Luxemburg. And you're like, yes, we're here to create this utopia. You know, we're soldiers of the revolution. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all right. What if the capitalist imperialists invaded? Well, we would have to go back to being guerrillas and revolutionaries. And we would be in the cafes plotting, just like Lenin, just like Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, you know, we would plot, we would revolt. And, you know, that's sort of the kind of collectively narcissistic narrative in your mind. And then the shit happens and they open the wall and everything is fucked. And the next thing you can't even go to the office because the office is like closed. Like, the building is closed. And you're like, all right, now we got to do it. Let's order some coffees. And how do you make a bomb again? Right? You know, and then they're just like, and if you say to these people, hey, you know what? Actually, I'm sorry, it really is over. You worked hard for the state. Now the state is Germany as a whole. We understand that you work for the state. You know, here's your pension check. You know, like, think about your roses, right? You know, it takes hard work to have really pretty roses. You've got to prune, you've got to snip, you know. And they just go off and cultivate their roses, and it's like done, right? And that's sort of, in a way, exactly what's happening to the USAID people right now, is they're just like, it's just over. And somehow the Supreme Court let them do this, you know, and it's just over. And of course, my response is like, all right, scale that up 10x or 20x.
So do you think we could do that with our quangos and our charities?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Hope not.
Because civil service. Because we have a massive civil service.
Because, of course, and the thing is that basically that civil service, like, who really loves Whitehall?
You know, the people who work there.
Well, that's the thing. There's a lot the of people who work there love Whitehall. You know, who loves Whitehall? Alistair Campbell loves Whitehall.
Yeah, I'm really excited to.
It will be really fun going up against Alistair Campbell.
I was going to say about the, in terms of like the USAID, I just call it USAID, but yeah.
Some call it USAID, some call it USA. I grew up calling it USAID. But apparently, I think more people call you a Zane.
Yeah, now, but I feel like your own, your like infamous essay on the elves and the hobbits and which was obviously done in, you know, in response to the Roe v. Wade thing. It felt like it was you saying, there's no way you can overturn this without any sort of, backlash. And then the backlash kind of didn't come, which is, it's in line with what you said.
Yeah, like, the backlash actually didn't come because these regimes are like very, very tired.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, the enthusiasm of the people who created them was like incredible. And so it's like, you know, here is one example of that, which when I read, I was like, wow, you know, which is that, you know, everyone who's sort of familiar with like U.S. history and feels that they're part of this tradition remembers John F. Kennedy and the new frontier. We're going to, you know, the new frontier that would later become the Great Society, you know, this like powerful utopian program. And Kennedy is, he's young, he's decisive. He doesn't wear a fucking hat because he doesn't need to wear a fucking hat because he's got good fucking hair. Like me, right? You know, and he's got the good hair, you know, he's young.
Yeah, you're
he's
not
dynamic.
Norwooding at all.
Yeah, not Norwooding at all, you know, and he's young.
Very luscious.
And his wife is hot as well, right? You know, Jackie Kennedy, right? You know, everything is like very exciting about the Kennedy administration. And there's this famous book that was written before the assassination called The Making of the President. 1960 by, I think, T.H. White, who I always confuse with E.B. White and also with the author of The Once and Future King. You know, I'm not sure I think T.H. White might be the Once and Future King guy, but, you know. Anyway, his name is White. He's a famous American journalist. And he's writing like 1962, and he's talking about the new frontier, and he goes and talks to like a new dealer. And the new dealer, who's from the 1930s, is just like, yeah, man, if you weren't there in the New Deal, like, everything's fucking boring. Like, you know, and like, to someone in DC today, the idea of like, I would, you know, being part of like the Kennedy administration would have been like incredible.
Yeah.
But the fact that that pales in comparison to the Roosevelt administration, it's like,
okay, I want to pin this down to the British context, if that's okay.
And so the path into this elite, the path into this like quangocracy elite.
Yeah.
Think about all the like 17-year-olds in Britain. These are horrible people, but I want you to think about them. Think about all the 17-year-olds in Great Britain who want to be Alistair Campbell when they grow up. Yeah, exactly. So first of all, like, you know, these are people who are like, have a very kind of slave mentality because like, you know, they're not trying to be something different and new, and they're all trying to climb this greasy pole. And you all, you know, when you went to school, you all knew the people who were just like totally dedicated to climbing the pole. And they're just like horrible fucking people. They're like really like you're just like, and they're horrible people, and they're like, they're people that are like very good at subordinating whatever they think to whatever they're supposed to think.
Sure.
They're exactly like the people who become majors in the Stasi in the GDR in like 1975.
Yeah.
They're like totally conformist and total power slaves.
But
Charles III. Now Charles III tomorrow takes ayahuasca. Okay, let's imagine the king.
I could see it.
The king, I could see it. He goes to Brazil. He's just like, he gets, you know, he's a fashion victim, right? And he's like, the fashion now is psychedelics. So, you know, in the really proper, authentic way, okay, to do psychedelics, to do ayahuasca is just like, you can get it from like white people. No, you got to go to the jungle.
Yeah.
He goes to the jungle incognito. No one knows.
Have you done ayahuasca?
I have not actually. But, I have a story. But I thought this was just beer. You know, I have a funny story, you know, thereabouts. But, you know, he goes, he does his ayahuasca. He is visited by the spirit of every king of England, going back to fucking Alfred. Right. You know, and,
Shout out. And
they're all just like, no, you gotta be a king.
Mm.
And he comes back and he's just like, wow, I gotta be a king. You know, and he says to the military, all right, you know, just, you know, Englishmen to me, follow me, and we're gonna get rid of all these quangos. You know, do you think the kind of people who are in the British military are not going to follow him?
No. I totally
do you think
agree.
That the quangos are gonna fight back against those people? Also no. And the thing is, when a regime, when power changes in that way, like everyone sort of feels like this kind of changing of the guard vibe. They feel, and when you're in a regime that is losing power, it's like being in a company that's going out of business, which is an experience that I have had. It's like desolating. Yeah. It's so demoralizing. The last thing you're going to do is fight. You're going to give up.
That's like,
and the excitement of the people that basically realize, holy crap, we can do anything we want in England except change a man into a woman or a woman into a man.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and not just England. You know, you're like, what if we took the empire back? You know, we could start with South Africa, you know, like, and like, who's going to stop us there? Like, you know, what do they have, three operating like airplanes, you know, like.
So, I mean, this is your third criterion for regime change, right? This like interior legitimacy. And you say it needs to get to that point for the regime to actually fall. You need the people actually working within the system to change their minds. And then it happens really fast.
Yeah. And the thing is, when those people within the system, that's the thing about the system we have, is that the people within the system are time servers. They're power whores. They're just like, they're people. They would be Nazis in Nazi Germany. They would be Bolsheviks in Russia. They're actually like followers. This is a whole world of followers. They think they're leaders.
But they need something else to replace the power that they currently subscribe
they
to.
They need to, you know, they're like.
So where does that come from in your model? Does that come from culture?